Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Roughly 50 South American migrants are being offered transportation to temporary shelter and services at Joint Base Cape Cod. The Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, or MEMA, is taking a lead for the Baker administration. This is 2 days after the migrants arrived on Martha's Vineyard after they were lured onto charter planes with promises of jobs and shelter in Boston. WBUR reporter Simone Rios is on the vineyard, joins us now. Simone, thanks for checking in.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Simone, I just lost you there. I'm going to ask you what's happening right now. There you are. Yeah, got you now. I know this is, you're in the minute there, Simone, and I know that it's maybe a little bit of rough sound, but we want to check in. What's happening now? Okay, so we're having some trouble with Simone Rios' sound. We'll try to get Simone back. We've just given you a big piece of the update, which is the move by the Baker administration. Joining us for the day, or a good chunk of it today, to kind of help us get perspective is Jeff Thielman. He is the president and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which helps immigrants resettle and seek asylum once they've come to the U.S. Jeff, thanks for being here in Studio 2. I know you're going to kind of ride along with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll get Simone back in a minute. I want to ask you, as we come into today, 48 hours into how this is unfolding, what is top of mind for you?
Top of mind is how much these people are dealing with trauma, what they're going through right now. I'm thinking of them. I'm thinking of their families. I think they're in a situation where they are getting some immediate warmth, and they're being welcomed by people from the vineyard. I'm not surprised by that, by the way. The people from the vineyard, the people in Massachusetts are welcoming people, and actually people all over the country will come to places where people are in crisis and welcome them, provide them with food and clothing and shelter. But then I'm thinking about the next steps that are going to be difficult. They're going to have to eventually find their way in the United States. They're going to have to, many of them have asylum claims pending, apparently all over the country. So I'm thinking, how are they going to get that done? I'm thinking, how are they going to find affordable housing? I'm thinking about, you know, what's their long-term plan? They have children, many of them, so we've got to get these kids in school. So I'm thinking about the many, many challenges these folks have coming up.
So, Jeff, you've laid out several things that I'll come back to you, and I want to dig into more. I mean, that's why we're here today, is to go beneath the headlines on this story. I do think we have Simone back again, who's reporting basically streetside in Martha's Vineyard. Simone, do we have you back?
Yes, I'm here, Tiziana.
Great. And what's happening right now, Simone?
So we woke up this morning, and it seemed there was some movement at the shelter where they were staying. I'm in Edgartown. St. Andrew's Episcopal Church is where all this was happening, where they stayed after they were dropped off on the island. And we got over there around 9 a.m., and folks were packing their bags and getting ready to get on a bus. I spoke to one of the migrants. He said that they were told that they were going to be leaving at 9:45, and sure enough, a few minutes after that, three buses came up, chartered by local officials, to bring them to the ferry in Vineyard Haven, and then to bring them back to the Cape, where they're going to be staying at the Otis Air Base.
Was he feeling good about making that move? This is voluntary, Simone. Was he feeling like, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot of confusion. The fact that they were dropped off here, not having any idea what Martha's Vineyard was. They were given all kinds of promises that they were going to have work and even English classes, all kinds of stuff. And then they were dropped off here with no notice to local officials. So there's so much confusion, as you can imagine. But they've been received so warmly here on the island, folks bringing, you know, money and supplies and every just huge outpouring. So I think people felt the Venezuelans felt very gratified for all the help that they were getting. Really not having a super clear idea of what would come next, but they seem to feel like they were in good hands.
I'm actually going to play a little sound here, Simone, and you are interpreting in this sound. This was a little bit earlier yesterday. You had a chance to speak with several people who came on the plane. Here's a bit of what one of them had to say to you.
Al principio sí estuvimos preocupados, pero ahorita estamos.
In the beginning, we were worried, she said.
But now we're relaxed because the people here have given us so much help.
And we're not using their name because of fear of deportation. It underscores what you just told us, Simone. It also makes me wonder about that in the beginning piece. What did it take? What about the journey to get here? And do they feel used?
You know, the journey, from what I've spoke to three or four of them in depth, and it seems they left Venezuela in July and came by land through the jungle of Panama, where they were escorted by indigenous tribes, and they would sort of control one little territory and then pass them off to another tribe. They were treated very well by these indigenous folks, and then they made it up through Central America into Mexico, crossed the Rio Grande, and then turned themselves into immigration authorities where they would apply for asylum. Then they were released, and they were approached by this strange character who they only knew as Perla, like pearl in Spanish, who offered to help them out. And they believed her. They thought she was operating in good faith. And it turns out that they were brought to this strange island. They had no idea. They'd never even heard of it. And so they were just so surprised and so shocked by the whole experience. But you know, now that they're here, they seem to be in good care. I mean, the whole Massachusetts political establishment has basically rallied behind them. They have legal support, which they didn't have. So it's kind of an irony that you know, just a few days ago they were on their own in Texas. They got lured to come here to Martha's Vineyard, and they didn't have legal representation. They didn't have anything except immigration appointments, and now they seem to be in good hands.
Simone, will you follow this through the weekend, especially as folks move to Joint Base Cape Cod?
Yes, we will, Tiziana. We'll see what comes next. We're going to be on the island for most of today, looking at how Martha's Vineyard has reacted to this amazing event that one islander said they haven't seen so much media attention since Chappaquiddick back in the 1960s. So that's what we'll be looking at today, and we'll definitely hope to stay in touch with some of the migrants and tell their stories as they continue.
All right, WBUR reporter Simone Rios, I know you're in the middle of it there. Thank you so much for joining us from Martha's Vineyard.
Thank you so much for having me.
So turning back to Jeff Thielman, who's here in Studio 2, CEO and president of the International Institute of New England, anything new that you learned from Simone there, or anything that really caught your attention?
Well, what caught my attention is that, you know, there is a plan. State authorities have gotten together. They have a plan to move people from the island to Joint Base Cape Cod. That's a positive development. My understanding, actually, I was talking to Mary Truong today, the director of the Massachusetts Office of Refugees and Immigrants, and the Baker administration is assembling people to try to figure out a more comprehensive plan to help these folks. So that's good news. I think, I hear a lot of good news there. I'm not surprised, as I said earlier, by the generosity of the islanders. Those are folks, like all folks across the country, that come and welcome people who are in need of help. And it sounds like they're on the right path. I will tell you, the situation with the woman Perla, who tricked them into getting on the planes, is a serious situation that's going to have to be investigated, and we'll see where it takes us. I mean, these folks have been lured under false pretenses to a place that's not how we do things in the United States of America. We don't operate like that. What happened was wrong morally. It may be wrong legally. We'll see.
All right, so Jeff, stand by, because we're going to bring a personal story now. Meet Katrine. She and her two children, ages 4 and 10, landed in Boston about a month ago after traveling from her home in Columbia. We're not using Katrine's last name to protect her safety as well. Katrine and her children spoke with us yesterday from La Colaborativa in Chelsea, which has been helping them settle in the area. And Juan Camilo Saavedra works at La Colaborativa. He helped interpret for us. We started by asking Katrine, why she immigrated to the U.S.
Vengo por violencia, porque lamentablemente en Colombia hay grupos armados, y no sé si la habrán escuchado.
Catherine saying because of violence, violence back home in Colombia. She says, as you might all know, Colombia has certain regions where there's a conflict, long historic conflict, that has affected the country deeply. and where she was living, her kids were at risk of being recruited by some of these illegal groups. And so she was working, and they were asking for more money. And when she wasn't able to pay them anymore, they were threatening her to take away her oldest 10-year-old. And so without thinking, the next day she packed her bags, went across the desert, and now she's here in the United States.
And what did it take to get to the southern border? Tell us about your journey to the southern border of the United States.
So, Catherine, I was able to take notes. So, Catherine, she comes from Departamento del Meta, which is the middle of the country. From there, she left her home, her homeland, and went to the capital, to Bogota. In Bogota, she was able to meet someone who helped her out and get her a flight to Mexico, to Cancun. That was the first time she left the country, and she started her immigration journey from Cancun. In Cancun, someone helped her out. Along the route, she met people who were with great hearts helping her out, and she was telling her story. She found a bus who took her to León Bahío, which is a small town in the country. And from León Bahío, she took another bus and crossed the whole country all the way north to the border with Tijuana. In Tijuana, she encountered a very dangerous city as well. People were telling her that Tijuana was even more dangerous than Colombia, and so she didn't want to stay in Mexico whatsoever. And so she paid someone that would help her cross the desert on foot, where she felt hunger, she felt thirst, heat exhaustion. Imagine doing this with two kids, she asks us. And so she arrived at the border with the United States. Immigration catched her in the border with California. And from California, she found a Catholic foundation, a network of churches who were hosting them and giving them food, giving them showers. And eventually she was sent on a flight to Boston, to the airport, where she had contacted one of her family members, a very far removed family member, who was supposed to pick her up here at Logan, but never showed up. So she slept here at Logan for 4 days until she found someone who came and picked her up, stayed at her house, gave her food, gave her showers. And then she says she's arrived to the United States, she's arrived to Boston, but she has no resources, she has no money. And this is where she's at right now.
How old are your kids, Catherine?
They are 4 years old and 10 years old.
How are they?
Struggling every day. Every day is a constant struggle. Every day is very uncertain. Her 10-year-old is in school. She was able to enroll him into the school system. And now she's desperate to find resources and income. Her dream was to get to this country and start working to be able to feed her kids and be independent. But that dream has become a lot more difficult with the reality here in the United States. And her 4-year-old, she's now wanting to put her 4-year-old in child care for her to be able to have some sort of independence and go out there to find some sort of job. So she's now hoping that she can find someone who take care of her kids so that she can go in and work. That's her dream right now.
Are you frightened or angry or hopeful, Catherine? How are you?
She's feeling a little desperation. Sometimes she can't find herself and doesn't really understand why what's happening or why she's in this situation. She just wants a house. She just wants a job. She wants to be able to work. She only has two backpacks, and that's all of her possessions. And she doesn't know what's going to happen. So there's a lot of instability, and her dream is to have some stability.
Catherine, what do you need most right now?
Catherine says that the most important thing right now is to find stability through getting her papers, especially her work permit. That's the only obstacle that she needs right now to be able to work. That's what she just wants. She wants to work and have a dignified and honest living and income. Getting her documents straight is the most important. And she's heard that if she doesn't have a work permit, she cannot work here. or if she gets hired, they're going to pay you a lot less, almost a non-living wage. And she doesn't want that. She wants to have an honest work, life, income, and eventually find a house for her family.
One last question. Catherine, what do you want most for your kids?
Que estén bien y pues digo que estén, que tengan su casa donde.
She wants them to be okay, to have a house, to have school, education, to have food on the table, just a normal life like every other human being.
That was Catherine from Colombia with interpretation from Juan Camilo Saavedra, an employee with La Colaborativa. Jeff Thielman, stay with us. I'm going to give you a minute or so to absorb that story, and then we can talk about it. We're diving beneath the headlines of the treatment of migrants from South America lured onto a plane in Texas and left on Martha's Vineyard this week. Today, they're being offered transport to Joint Base Cape Cod by the Baker administration, where they'll receive shelter services and other support. Still with us here in Studio 2, Jeff Thielman, president and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which helps immigrants resettle and seek asylum once they've come to the U.S. Jeff, we just heard a few moments ago the story of Catherine, who fled Colombia and is now getting support from La Colaborativa in Chelsea. That journey, bringing your children somewhere safer, it sounded like a terrifying road. Your reactions to the story?
You know, my reaction is I see someone like Catherine as a hero. I mean, we have 4,000 people in services at the International Institute of New England, many of them with similar stories. And every time I see, especially a mom who actually comes to the United States the way she did, I am inspired. I'm in awe. It brings tears to my eyes. Many days it does. She listen to the story. She escaped violence in her home city. She needed to get out of there. She took, I don't know, multiple buses to get from Colombia to a plane, then multiple buses to get from Mexico to the United States. She crosses the border. She's in the airport in Logan for 4 days without any help. I mean, this is a survivor. This is the kind of person you want in the United States of America. And what did she say to the reporter and to you? She said her first goal was to find a job. See, that's what immigrants want to do when they come to the United States of America. They want to get an EAD, an employee authorization document. They want to get a job. They want to make money, and they want to contribute. That's what they want to do. They're not thinking about a governmental system that's going to give them money. They're not thinking about a handout. They're not thinking about an easy way through. They know it's going to be hard. They've already suffered a great deal. She suffered a tremendous amount over the past couple of years of her life. She's got a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old that she's raising. And she's found a way to get the 10-year-old in school. She wants to get the 4-year-old in school. And she wants to work. That's the kind of folks we need in this country. And actually, those are the kind of folks that have built the country and built the region.
And do you feel like that's lost in the conversation?
Absolutely. People get political. They get, you know, they get angry because, you know, somebody comes across the border and they're undocumented. Well, she's going to apply for asylum, and she has a pretty good case for it based on what she said, because she's faced persecution and violence in her home country. And so, yeah, that always gets lost in the conversation. People forget that folks like this will get a job. They will contribute. Their kids will contribute and do great things. But don't forget, and I was at a naturalization ceremony this morning at the State House. Brought tears to my eyes. It always does. Every time I go to there, I like a typical guy, people ask me, are you okay? And I said, allergies. You know, I don't want to admit. I don't want to admit that I teared up, but I did. And, you know, those folks that came here worked their tails off to get to that point. And that's what she will do. And that's what we need. So, I mean, Catherine is a hero to me. She's someone I admire, and she's the reason why I do what I do every day.
All right, Jeff Thielman, with that ringing in our ears, sit tight, because we're going to bring one more story now, and this time it's Carlos. He arrived in the region in August with his 3 children. We're not using Carlos's last name either to protect his identity and safety. Once again, La Colaborativa in Chelsea is supporting the family, and Juan Camilo Saavedra interpreted for us. And we started by asking Carlos if the hard journey to get here was worth it.
Es que sí, sí, porque
yes, it's worth it because I have some tranquility or peace of mind, knowing that I'm not gonna be hurt or something bad is gonna happen to my family. I know it's hard, but at least that's a big weight that was lifted off my shoulders here in the U.S.
Tell me about your family, Carlos.
Pues nosotros.
So Carlos has 3 kids. When he's in Colombia, he is here right now with 2 of them, and the oldest one couldn't come to the interview. His wife left him, left the whole family when they were in Colombia. He's from Medellin, a city, one of the second largest city of the country. and he worked at a private insurance, EPS. When he was working there, things got really complicated at the household because he was going to work and his youngest were staying at home alone now that his wife wasn't there. And so his kids were going out to the streets and playing soccer, but in his neighborhood is known as a neighborhood where people from other regions of the country come and live there. And his kids was being recruited and being influenced by groups of young kids who were unfortunately were involved in criminal activities, selling drugs. And so he started to get mad at his kid. He started to get worried that he was going to lose him to these groups of people. And so he decided to move out of the city, and he moved out to a small town called San Roque, Antioquia. But they started to follow him. They started to follow his kid. And he then moved once again to another town where his mom lives. And so he's then got scared that they were still going to follow him and his family all the way to his mom, and something bad could happen to his mom. And so that was the moment when he decided to start selling everything he owned. He sold his car, he sold his properties. And he, in Colombia right now, he is in so much debt. Then someone lent him more money to be able to start his journey to the United States. And now he's here. His family told him that he cannot complain. He reached his goal. And so he has, he's conflicted with the situation. He just wants to be able to send his kids to childcare, but he said it is too expensive. And if he tries to find a job that pays him $15 an hour, that's miserable salary. So it's not even going to pay for childcare. And so at least right now, he feels at peace because he's able to be with his kids. But he knows big challenges are going to come up ahead.
Carlos, do you feel your children are safe now?
He's at peace right now, and his kids are going to school, and that's something that he's feeling very good about. Here, he feels that they're going to learn another language, which is a huge opportunity and could open other doors. And he feels that here in the United States, as everybody says, there's more opportunity to become someone or to have a living. And so that keeps his hopes really high. Back home in Colombia, there's no future. Everything's a little bit more complicated. There's no social mobility whatsoever. And you're just stuck. Even in the town where he was living, the criminal illegal groups were controlling the price of eggs. They were controlling the amount of eggs that could be sold. They controlled commerce. They controlled traffic. They controlled policing. And so he felt stuck. And so at least here, he doesn't feel that he feels that the situation is a little bit better in those terms.
Carlos, if someone else you knew in Colombia wanted to come to the U.S., would you say do it?
He says if someone over there in Colombia is in a similar situation as he was, he would say yes. He was in a situation where he was being followed, he was being harassed, he was being persecuted. He even went to school. He's an engineer, and he was making money over there in Colombia that obviously is not enough to live here, but it was okay to live over there. And so if someone is in that tense situation and stressful situation and conflict like he was, I mean, he would recommend them to come into the U.S. Although he says that it was extremely hard to reach the United States. But even then, for what he was going through over there in Colombia, he feels a little bit more at peace here.
And in one sentence, Carlos, do you feel welcome here?
Sí, sí, porque a pesar de que no tengo papeles para trabajar, que no he tenido como lo poco que he estado tranquilo.
Yes. Wait, I got a little bit emotional.
It's okay.
He said yes. He feels very welcomed. He felt very welcome from the beginning. People have been very helpful so far. He is hopeful because his kids are now going to school, and that is the most important. Imagine he's saying he was an engineer and he was not going to be even able to pay him at university back in Colombia, but at least right now he's going to school. He doesn't care what happens to him. What he really wants is that his kids move forward in life, study, get education, become someone in life. And for now, that has been... It seems like that's the trajectory that he's going so far.
Carlos, thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Yes, you're welcome.
Carlos, who crossed the southern border from Colombia with interpretation from Juan Camilo Saavedra. And we want to thank La Colaborativa for connecting us with both Carlos and Katrine. We'll have one more family story for you next week. Turning back now to Jeff Thielman, still here in Studio 2, an expert in resettlement and immigration and CEO of the International Institute of New England. Jeff, I could almost hear two different listeners in my head, one saying, this is why we have to help, and another saying, he was a victim in his country. We should be working with his country so that he doesn't have to be in the United States. And there are narratives both there. How do we think about that?
Well, I mean, both listeners are right. I mean, we should be working with a country like Colombia to help them address their issues so that people stay there. There shouldn't be violence in countries and like Colombia. And when there is, people will flee and they'll come to the United States. And under our laws, they have a chance to apply for asylum and stay here. So that listener is right. We should be doing something to help Colombia. But we can't really solve all the problems of every single country in the world. And so, you know, Carlos is here. He has struggled to get here. He fought his way to the United States. He brought two of his children who are now enrolled in school. Those kids are going to start to contribute, and he's going to start to contribute eventually. The one thing that comes to mind is, you know, as I was listening to his story, he's kind of typical of a lot of people that are trying to enter the workforce today. He needs to learn English, he said, when you interviewed him. He needs an employer authorization document. He needs some skills. And so we have a challenge in the workforce, which is preparing people who don't speak English or whose English is not their first language, who don't have the skills for a workforce that needs thousands of people right now. So when I hear the two stories, yes, we need to solve the problems in countries that are outside of our jurisdiction. We need to help them address these issues so people stay there and create lives there. At the same time, when they finally get here after quite a struggle, we need to welcome them and help them integrate into our communities.
So let's try to put these last 48 hours now in perspective, mm-hmm. Jeff. So you've got a Carlos with three kids. He's not on Martha's Vineyard, maybe going to Joint Base Cape Cod, but another Carlos with three kids maybe is.
Sure.
We have short-term support ready for them there. You talked about, you know, the irony of legal support now. Simone Rios talked about the fact that some people maybe even missed appointments for asylum status because they applied, and those may be all over the country. What needs to happen in the next couple of weeks now?
I think what needs to happen, and I think what is beginning to happen, is that groups around the state are coming together to talk about how do we help these people. So, you know, the Ivan Madrigal's group has already found lawyers for people. That's a great thing. So there's groups of attorneys that are starting to help these folks. The social services network in the state is prepared to do something to try to help people integrate and find housing and stay in the state if possible. So I think the way things work in this state is that when a crisis occurs, like when the Afghans came, Haitians, we have 500 Haitians in our services right now. We have 542 people from Afghanistan. We have 270 people from Ukraine. When that happens, groups come together. They reach out. Hospitals reach out. Community health centers reach out. All sorts of people that are in the caring profession, in human services, in healthcare, come together to try to figure out how to work this out. We have a call every 2 weeks with all of the resettlement directors in the state of Massachusetts. All six of us and some of our staffs get on a call, and we commiserate, we share best practices, we share ideas, we're in touch with each other, and we're all talking about how do we help people. That's what the conversation is about, not about us. It's about how to help people. So I think people are ready to help. I do think we need leadership, and I think we're going to start to see it from Governor Baker. I'm confident that'll happen, to try to give us a comprehensive path forward that involves some state funding to make sure these people are supported at least for the short term as they start their lives in Massachusetts. They can't stay on Cape Cod, Joint Base Cape Cod, for a long period of time. They're eventually going to have to leave there and find housing.
All right. So just so folks know, Ivan Espinoza Madrigal, that's Lawyers for Civil Rights. We've had him here on the show before.
Yep.
We've really stayed focused in the lives and the impact of the migrants. I do want to ask you one question. You just said you're hoping for more leadership from Governor Baker. He's made a very clear choice not to call out Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has claimed responsibility for this act and has stayed really focused on the humanitarian response. Do you need him to do something differently than that from a public policy perspective for the work you do with migrants at the International Institute?
Oh, well, that's a...
No, it's a tough
that's
question.
That's a tough question. I mean, I would say, you know, first of all, we need him focused on the humanitarian response. And I think he and his administration are focused on that. I think Mary Lou Sutter's, the whole team at Health and Human Services, is focused on how we can help these people in great need right now. In addition, I personally would like him to call out DeSantis for what he did. Because I think what he did was awful. It was wrong. It was a stupid political stunt when you think about it. These people were in Texas. They weren't even in his state. He was using money out of his state budget. He paid somebody named Perla to trick him into getting on a plane. I mean, the whole thing is bizarre. It's probably illegal. And yeah, I would like the governor to call out DeSantis, Ron DeSantis, and Texas Governor Greg Abbott for behaving badly and not acting as responsible leaders or responsible stewards of their own state's money. The way they're behaving. So, yeah, I'd like him to call. Would it be helpful to us? It would be helpful, sure. I'd like him to do it. If he doesn't do it, it's okay by me. The most important thing is that he and his team focus on the humanitarian response, which they seem to be doing.
All right. One word answer. Was this week tragedy or resilience?
Resilience. I mean, I clearly go with resilience. I know you want a one word. Sorry about that.
That's
I
all right.
Messed up.
Jeff Thielman is the president and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which helps immigrants resettle and seek asylum once they've come to the U.S. This was so helpful. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Joining us.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
All art can be powerful, but art that's tied to a place can offer an even deeper connection. Artist Kermima Deborah McMillan thought a lot about that before she created her newest piece. It's a 6x60-foot mural across the street from Freedom House in Dorchester, and it's beautiful. It features bright, sparkling colors, seals commemorating leaders from Freedom House, and as she describes it, a real sense that there's magic all around us. McMillan created the mural in conjunction with Now and There, a Boston organization that helps curate public art, especially with artists who, quote, break down biases and shed light on often overlooked people and issues while also providing moments of joy and respite, end quote. We sat down with Kermima Deborah, or Mima, and Charlotte Jones, a member of the Now and There board of directors, to talk about the unveiling of Mima's mural this week. And I started by asking Mima about this theme of celebrating the unsung heroes in a community, how she decided to highlight the work being done at Freedom House.
The project started by a concept that I called Unsung Heroes. And what I wanted to do was allow for the community to choose who they felt was doing the work and weren't asking for the accolades. And so I did this little project where I passed around cards that had a QR code, and it was anonymous for them to vote. Went to a couple of events in Dorchester and Roxbury and just talked to the community about who they felt was doing the work. And time again, the Freedom House came up. And I thought to myself, why don't I just go introduce myself? Contacted them, asked if I could come in and talk to them about their amazing facility and what they did in the community, and they invited me with open arms. I was just really amazed at the work that they have been doing for over 70 years. Being an educator myself, I understand what it takes to be a mentor and also to mentor those kids that have never had any information about universities, how they work, what it meant to go to college, what it meant to graduate, what it could do, what success meant, and how success could mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people. And the Freedom House is the type of place that embraces it all.
Charlotte, with that in mind, and we do have this space and this work of Freedom House that's situated in the Civil Rights, founded in 1949. Members of Freedom House staff and founders over time, spending time with everyone from Martin Luther King Jr., John F. Kennedy, through to today. It's an important space, and that's an important legacy. Help me understand what it means to bring art. Like, this is art in a place. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to bring art to a place like this?
Well, the thing about art is always probing communities. It's always asking a question. It's always illuminating value. It's always it's always communicating, and it's a part of every thread of what we humans have always done. Now and there, in terms of selecting places, it's not, we don't unilaterally make the selections per se. We work with artists to support their selection to eliminate power of place, and that often has to do with a place's relationship to Boston and to all of us who live in and around the Boston area. What does it mean to bring art to Freedom House? I think you look at what MIMA's work is doing and how it's placing what their purpose is back on the map. You know, a lot of institutions that have that kind of history, it's easy for them to be forgotten about, where they're not front and center. You're not opening the paper and reading about these things. And so one of the things that I think that it means is it's an opportunity to reengage the important commitment that this house has had and continues to have in our community. You know, it's catching people doing really good things while no one's watching. And so we actually get to cast a light on what they're doing so that people can kind of know and be more informed about not only the history of the place, but the power of the people who are there today and remaking this institution so that it continues to thrive and grow.
So I love this idea that Charlotte just gave us, Mima, of catching people doing really good things.
Right.
So now I want to talk about the art itself, the mural, which is full of bold colors. It harkens back to an art style of, and I'll admit I was a child at this time, 1970s. And there are words like grow, there are children, and it's got this long, winding rainbow road kind of feel to it. How do you even begin to think about what a piece of art like this is going to look like?
Well, I am also a child of the 70s.
I was told there would be no numbers in this conversation.
I love Michael Jackson, and I also love Wizard of Oz, The Wiz, Alice in Wonderland, Sun Ra, Space is the Place. It's like all of those things combined. And for me, it's always about that yellow brick road. You know, it is, you're on the golden path. You know, you got to find your way. Sometimes you get off and you make a wrong turn, but that path is still golden, so you'll find it. And my whole concept behind even applying to Now and There and even being considered for this type of work was to do something that was uplifting. A lot of the times my work talks about violence in Black communities, and I wanted to do something that was about magic, you know, something that a little girl would see and see herself and know that she's seen and that somebody sees her and recognizes her for the wonderful potential that she has. So with the Freedom House being around for so long and just being who they are, they're just doing the work. You know, to them, it's nothing special. It's just what they do. They invited me to come in to a staff meeting, and the staff was just as amazing. I was just like, I want to hang out with you guys. I was like, I wish that there was a Freedom House when I was in school, you know, to be able to help me navigate those university waters and to have someone to follow you. You know, they mentor these kids sometimes from junior high to high school all the way to college. The same mentor works with the same kids all the way to university to make sure they graduate. I just think that that is so amazing, you know, that they have the space to be able to do that. And so it wasn't hard for me to imagine something that was really bright and magical and fun. All the people in the mural are glitter people, so it's like black glitter paper. I love making the clothes like paper dolls. Everybody loves her gold boots and the wonderful outfit. And, you know, and it's like, it's a celebration. You know, the two people that I highlight, Katrina Shaw and Charmaine Arthur, Charmaine is the current CEO.
She's fabulous.
She was just so amazing. Right. She spoke so well about Katrina and all the work that she did. And this was before I even knew what I was going to do. I had to interview them, see, have a feeling. I didn't know what I was going to make. And she asked me, she said, you know, Katrina was such a highlight to us and helped us so much. Is there any way you can do something in your mural that highlights her? And I was like, wow, this is so amazing that, you know, you recognize the work that the former CEO has done and that they still valued her as a contributor to the Freedom House. And now that she's the current CEO, just that love that I felt from that interaction. And I thought to myself, Charmaine doesn't know this, but I'm going to highlight her as well.
And so, you know, what you have is you have this yellow brick road, right? And then we have the children in the gold boots and the sparkle. And then we have what feel like almost official seals, right? It almost looks like we've put somebody on a coin or put them on money, right? This moment of honor where we see Katrina Shaw and we see Charmaine Arthur. And I'll turn to Charlotte Jones here. We're speaking with Mima McMillan and Charlotte Jones about this installation, this public art installation outside of Freedom House. Charlotte, you start with the artist.
Yeah.
What do you seek to honor? What does Now and There seek to honor in doing this work this way, bringing an artist to a community, developing art, putting it in a public space?
Well, that's a big question. But we are artists forward. The work is about, and it's about the artists and their vision, and it's about giving them the ability and the wherewithal to do the important work that artists do. We're an art-curated organization that seeks to bring these conversation to public spaces. And artists that dare to do that need a lot of support. Art is public, always. Mm. But doing that takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of resources to do that. So what we try to do and what we do through our accelerator program is we have developed a program that takes emerging artists and artists who are mid-career, and we give them an opportunity. It's an open call kind of program, and we give them not just the financial resources, I think a pretty good stipend to be a part of this sort of little mini ecosystem, you know, when you get into it, because you not only get the money, but you get the resources, the human resources as well, to activate your ideas. To do these ideas takes courage. It takes a lot of unseen skills. And those skills are knowing how to put a budget together, how to think about your project, how to bring your project to life.
But also how to pay yourself.
Yes, very important.
It's something that artists don't think they deserve or should be paid. You know, I think that was a really important component that Now and There talked about, that, you know, we are worth that and we should be paid for our time. And
absolutely.
And what that means. And, you know, I felt that they gave us the seeds. And now we have to go grow the flowers.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it's a lot to make work. You know, I think that, you know, people, you know, all of God's children are creative. I think we all are. I think, you know, creativity is a part of what makes us human, and that's all good. But to be an artist is a very discreet thing, and it requires a lot of risk. Even though you see an artist working in one venue, like with the accelerator program, it's amazing. We've had, you know, 23 artists come through this program, and they are doing all kinds of work. And inside one artist, they're experimenting. And we want to encourage that experimentation. They are experimenting with different disciplines of work. And we tend to flatten things out, you know, we tend to, especially in the visual culture that we live in, we tend not to look at or probe what's behind an image, or what's behind, what's the story, what's happening here? And sometimes to get at that, you get at it not necessarily through the brain, but through an emotional response. And we're not always processing on that level. So much of what we experience comes through our bodies. So to stand with a piece, or sit on a concrete furniture that one of the projects that we've done, we have to enable artists to take those bold steps and do that kind of risk-taking, because part of what artists do is they hold up a mirror for us. They demand curiosity of us. And you can't be curious if you're not courageous. And that's why it starts and it ends with the artist.
I'll pick up on that thread. And we're speaking with Sharla Jones, who's a member of the board of directors of Now and There, and artist Mima McMillan about public artwork. That doesn't even fully capture it, but we'll synthesize that for this moment. So, Mima, Sharla has used words like courageous, daring, risk-taking, experimenting. Is that who you think you are?
Absolutely. I think that the very first risk I took was when I went to kindergarten and had to explain that Carmima Deborah was my first name and I didn't have a middle name. That was my first risk. And where I proceeded to ask my mom, why in the world did you do this to me? And she replied, you'd be an artist one day and you're going to be the only one that has that name and you're going to really appreciate it. And so I think that to own a name like that, you had to build courage. I think that that was like my first mm-hmm. step. After that, everything else was a piece of cake. But, you know, in order to be innovative, you know, you have to be courageous. Not everyone is going to believe in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you also have self-doubts. And a lot of the time, you're working alone. And you're in your own space. And then all of a sudden, you're not. And so, you know, that's another step of courage, is coming out of your little cave and interacting with people and working and talking about things that have only just been in your mind, and to have to explain these things or to be inspired by someone that your work has touched is the reason why I do it. Mm-hmm. You know, In the end, I want people to ask more questions and to see that, you know, there are magical things that are happening right around you.
Mima McMillan, or Carmima Deborah McMillan, the artist, and Sharla Jones, member of the Now and There Board of Directors, which created and funded the Art Accelerator Program. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
For having us.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. He had help this week from Michaela Varela. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.